you if I never could do this, which is speaking from behind you. The question that I really want to start out with, it really deals with the first 5 weeks that we're going to be discussing. And I'm not going to say the question, but I'm going to ask you a series of questions. You guys need to pull these full chairs from the back. Does anyone recognize this? I mean the printing. I don't expect everybody to recognize it, but think of this one out. This is the Tender Canal, which is a fairly recent edition. It was put up by Breuer. If you're Bali Kriya and you want the best text that you can possibly use for Bali Kriya, this is really what you want to use. It comes in other printings as well, but I want to start out with this for just a moment. How did the story know he decided he wanted to print the Tanakh? Forget whose Tanakh this is for the moment. Forget that it's a Breuer Tanakh, and if you know what Breuer Tanakh is, and Kether on Tova, so you know something about that. But you want to print the Tanakh. How do you know what to print? What do you do? I want to volunteer. What's your name? Okay. So, you want to print the Tanakh. So what do you do?
Look at
it. Well, that would be one way of doing it. If you have a very clever answer, I'll say which one. But you're a regular person. You're looking at, you want to go print the Tanakh. What do most people, most of the firm printers in Brooklyn do? They go take another edition of the Tanakh, right? They go take another edition of the Tanakh, and they copy it. Say if they're very clever and they're sharp, maybe they make a few changes, and hopefully they change the font. So
if I were doing this, let's say, okay, and here's another version, I suspect that more of you would recognize this because this is Rebroyer's previous edition. There are at least three editions. This was put out by Horei. Some shuls have, like, Chamisha from Shakur with Shabbos Davening in the back that use this. And this is another version of that. So you might take the Tanakh like this, and you want now to put out the second Tanakh. Okay. Now, how are you sure that the Tanakh you put out is going to be the exact same as this Tanakh? Well, you copied it, but what's to ensure that you didn't make any mistakes?
A spell check.
Moshe Rabbeinu only had a spell check. Or a Benosha. Okay, what do you do? What's that? You know, the editor. Okay. Well, I don't know if editor is an appropriate term here because we don't edit, we just copy. So you have a copy editor.
Okay,
a copy editor. Okay, and what's to ensure the copy editor doesn't make mistakes? Another copy editor, you know? Our Ari's Law is. Yeah.
Protocol.
What does protocol mean? You mean how you copy?
Not just how you copy, but how you also copy editing.
Okay, well, give me an example.
You count the number of letters.
That's an excellent idea, okay? You can count the number of letters. I think that nobody in this room has ever had experience editing a text of any type, with like a rabbinical text, a text of Mishnah Gemara, producing a critical edition, using manuscripts. It's a good problem. Anybody an exception to that rule? I suspect at this stage not. But I can tell you that if you try this today, you will find that no matter how many times you go through it, and let's say you want to produce a computerized text of a manuscript. So somehow you type it out, and then you go back and you check, and then you go back and you check it again. And it seems almost no matter how many times, you will find that a little error here, another little error there. Eventually you won't. It's very, very difficult. And it's very easy to make mistakes in copying. In fact, I took the selection just for a moment so you can find it. On Kion Kshe Oref Atma. It's hard to tell just from a distance, but does anyone, those who know Trup, anyone know what is the Trup under the word key? If you may not need to see it, you know, if you know, what is it? Kion Kshe Oref Atma. Let me see if I can just use the mouse to point you.
Hold on. If you look where the pointer is, right there.
Can you see it? Right above the arrow. What's the Trup? It's a marathon. In fact, that makes sense.
If you go back for just a moment to the newer edition, I don't know how this happened, and you may not be able to see it on here. Let's see where it is. I circled it, but it's so hard to see.
Yeah, you're right. And there's a stray dot there. I'd like to believe it's a stray Catholic. You have to look at it severe there. It's not unreadable for those who know how to read Trump, but it's a little awkward, and certainly because it's different. But here you have somebody in the age of computers who has basically taken this one out, presumably not made any changes, and I will tell you that there's no basis for that being severe. I'm not going to tell you right now why that's the case. And yet there's a mistake that has occurred. Okay, so realize that the same person put out two different texts of Tanakh. It's obviously a trivial mistake. It's not has no larger ramification. But nonetheless, you'll notice that there is a mistake there. Now, when Rav Breuer did his earlier Tanakh, where would you have looked? So again, pretend you're not Rav Breuer and you don't go back, as one of you suggested, is to a codex. But you're going to go back to something else. We'll look at that something else in a moment. Before we do, I want to ask you a question. You can take out on the notes that you're writing. If I wanted to construct this text, forgetting about how I know what to put, what elements go into this text? What makes printed Tanakh? So leave out the sacred Torah for the moment. But that you should be thinking of that in a certain sense. What makes the sacred Torah, firstly? Like, that'd be an easy way of doing it. What's in the sacred Torah? Most of you, I think, have seen the sacred Torah. What's in the sacred Torah? You have to describe to someone and how they should write it. Forget the writing material. Just what's written there? What's written in the sacred Torah? What elements make it up? Yeah?
The letters.
Okay, we have letters. Okay, you have letters. Let's forget for the moment about the shapes of the letters, which are kind of hard. You have letters. What else do you have? Yeah. You have columns. Okay. Is that essential?
Yes.
Is it essential when you have above? Must that be above? And the answer is, yeah, it has to be above. It's on level better, it's a problem. If your column starts a little further, so you need to have columns, but there's a certain variety that can exist in a column. Okay, so you have the notion you have columns. You're writing text with a certain, up until a certain number of lines. Okay, what else? I will eventually learn your name. It takes me a while, but right now I'm not even thinking until we do the role. We'll do that later. Yeah.
Breaks in between, like, token or.
Okay, so plus. Now, does that appear in the sacred Torah?
Yeah.
Plus a break?
Parsha
breaks.
Well, it's not only Parsha.
There's Summa and Suha, the two kinds of Parsha breaks. And then there's also between Tarim, there's an X number of blank lines. Okay? Anything else in a sacred Torah? We're talking about things that contribute to the makeup of the text. Anything else? Yeah?
And they're all in certain states.
Okay, that's just separating letters or words. Okay, I mean, that is, word breaks if you want to count them. Yeah. Okay, so certain large and small letters would be found in the text itself. Anything else? So there are certain amudim which are supposed to start in a certain place. It's kind of known as the kashimo. It's not ma'ake, the sefer Torah, although it's pretty hard to write a sefer Torah where the first letter of the first column is in the base, which is the first one of those two amudim. Okay. Anything else? Right. Almost. I think it was off that list.
The letters instead of being on the bottom line,
they're
lined up to the top line.
I think that's only by OCERA, it would be a small letter.
All the letters are on, so they go instead of the bottom of the letter touching the line.
Oh, okay, that's fine. That's how you write a letter. The way you write a letter that, you know, has a hot soap, you know, the leg below. Okay, that's true. And one other minor thing.
That's
then.
Like
I said, we'll leave out the writing letter for now. The dots. There are two dots. There are maybe 10 or 11 in the Torah. Okay, then there's kudos. Okay. Now, those are all going to be contained within a printed text as well. What else is in a printed text? What goes into it? You're making your Tanakh. Okay? And you want to create a, your text, so what goes into it? What's here that's not the same as the Torah? Okay, you have something on the creative is a where it's read one way but it's written another way in the text, which is not indicated in the sacred Torah at all. What else?
Vowels.
Anything else? What else? There's more.
Sure.
Okay, anything else? Yeah.
Okay.
circuit breaks. Okay, that's technically part of traffic. That's sort of more elemental thing. You have circuit breaks.
Why is this doing this? Oh, come on, I'm going to sleep. Okay, I'll come back.
Okay, what else do you have?
Yeah.
Crocking brakes. Okay, you're going to put crocking brakes into your canal. Anything else? And something which you might consider appearing in, we already suggested, but go ahead. What's that? Okay, you have the arcs that you might put in there. What else? The number, okay, that's number of circum. That basically goes along with the parrot brake. But yeah, once you break up the truck, you're going to number the circum. Yeah?
Yeah, you can just.
Someone said these are the vowels already. Okay, yes?
Title.
You could put a title on top, which already should hint to something else that's going to be in your passages.
Partial names
and even more elements than
book
names. Okay, which means you're going to have book divisions as well. If you're doing not just a Torah, you're going to have a Torah and be a main student. Now, the questions you have to ask, and I think that about exhausts the list. And I realize, obviously, that producing a Tanakh is a major undertaking. Because there are lots and lots and lots and lots of little things you have to pay attention to. And lots of things that you have to know. The question is, where do you find out, where does all this information come from? Now, there's a popular misconception that made fun of by some. Others might not consider it a joke, that the truth about the whole shot came from Sinai. There's such a, people have something holy about the truth about. There can be something holy about the truth about, not holy, but important or sacred without being in Sinai. If people have sort of an impression, that which they see is that which always was. And that isn't always true. The question for each of these issues is where, not only, when you're printing the Tanakh, you want to know what you're supposed to print, where do these come from? So let me give you a fairly natural one, okay? Where did the crossing breaks come from? Yeah?
Were they not Christian?
That's what we think in the Bible, and along with that would go to the certain level. Okay? There's nothing particularly sacred about that. But I can tell you that if you were printing a Tanakh, you would do a terrible thing if you just put the crossing breaks in the number of the second. Which would be a terrible thing. It would be very inconvenient for starters, and some things have become part of the text, even if they're really not. Now, so that was very easy, right? We could dismiss that out of hand. What about the Nekudas? Where did the Nekudas come from? Now, before you say anything about the Nekudas, I want to show you the text of a Sefer Kodesh, and one could debate whether this was from Pharisee Jews or not, but it probably doesn't really matter because it would have looked roughly the same. I'm going to scroll back in history very quickly here. And I'm going to arrive at, okay, this. That is the Isaiah scroll.
And some of you may have trouble recognizing that as Hebrew at first, but if you spend a few minutes looking at it, you'll start to get used to the shape of the letters. Okay, this is a scroll that's on display in the Shrine of Books, the Israel Museum, so it's all the way around. Okay, and this, basically the entire city is shut out. I won't ask anybody to try to read, and I'll confess that at this first glance, except for if I know the pasuk already, I would have trouble reading every single letter. But this is what it looks like. Now, the letters, basically, most of these letters, if not touching each other, would probably be kosher with sacred cover. Two or three O's are enough, it would be fine. What's not in here? Nekudos are not in here. And if you could take this, the Isaiah scroll, I don't know exactly the data that's on it, but it's probably before the Common Era, at least a little bit. Any sacred Torah, any sacred that Chazal would not have had Nekudos in it, or so. So where did they come from? Okay, so we'll come to that in a moment. You're correct. It comes from Ben Asher and Tully. But the introduction, at least, of written symbols into the text comes later. And it doesn't happen in Sifrei Torah. It happens in a different kind of book that's known as a codex. But the codex, at least in Jewish circles, is probably not known until the 7th century. So until we get to the stage of the codex, anything that's going to be transmitted has to be transmitted outside. A crave sif is going to be transmitted outside. You're not going to see it. You read the text, you won't know about it. When you open up your Tanakh, you'll see it creates different marks in the margin.
Now, when they, when the Bali Masora, as we call them, wrote down the Sutras, where did they get these from? So, lest you think that they had only one option, so you recognize this, right? No, you don't. You recognize this, right? That looks very familiar. But if you go down one level here, this manuscript has the Kudos in it. I don't, this is probably around the year 1000. I don't remember exactly when. It looks a little different, doesn't it? Where are the Kudos? Yeah, are they the same Kudos you recognize? Some are, some aren't. Are there any Tehmani in here, or people with Tehmani roots? I'm glad, because if you had, if there was anybody, no, I'm not glad that there are no people with Tehmani roots, but I'm glad that if there were someone who was Tehmani originally wouldn't know what that was, I'd be a little disappointed. If you go a little further, here's another system. This is a very funny kind of Tanakh. Again, a similar dating period. This is very funny, because basically the first word of the Pasuk is there, and the rest of it is abbreviated. It's a very strange kind of paper. It's reminiscent of something. Anyone, does this remind anybody of something in the Mishnah or in the Gemara? Where the first word of the Pasuk is written and everything else is abbreviated, is abridged? No. Let me give you an example. Let me just find a Pasuk for you. Let's just take the beginning part. I think this is Yishayahu somewhere. Okay, if you look a little bit below where the arrow is, the chitin, which has the Yahushama, Kishamir Vashai, the Apple Art. It's very much a bridge, except for the word sort of chitin. Okay, it's early in Sefer Yishayahu. Okay, or something like that. Now, if you look at the Mikudos here, they don't look like the Mikudos that they just showed you. They are on top of the words, but they're not there in the first set. I thought, this I couldn't even tell you about exactly in any reason. So somebody created these sets of vowels. Now, it's not as if the people obviously didn't pronounce Hebrew. They did pronounce Hebrew. But they were the ones who created the system of vowels. Trup. Well, this you don't see trup in.
At least that I know of. But let's take a look at something else, which would be this. Does anyone recognize that? I'm sorry that it's so hard and it's not optimal conditions. Unless if you want to close the shades on it, make it
No.
Firstly, a word is, what is a codex? A codex is a book, as opposed to a sacred Torah, which is written on one side of the page, and it's a scroll. A codex was typically written on two sides of the page, and it had a margin, a binding. It was parchment. It wasn't something that was printed. The printing press was not invented until the 1400s. But the codex was a major event. Why is a codex a major event? It may not be given in a shul setting, but why is a codex a major event? Okay, and then there's a much more valuable aspect to a codex. I'm sure most of you know this. You go to shul, and the rabbi hasn't done his job, and it's Yom Tov. And it's, in the reading from the Sefer Matir, they have one Sefer, they need some custom braces, but, the last time a few was parts of Pinchas, if you're lucky. Maybe if you're not lucky, it's opposite and opposite, or even worse, you don't have it on the Sefer, and you just read the Zohar. And what happens? You've got to roll it. Codex is very convenient, it's like a book. Would you like your Gemara? Kiddushin's not even so long, you learn your Kabbalah. You know, school with it. Do you think it would be very handy having a Gemara written down in a scroll? I don't think so. It would be rather inconvenient. You would develop a better memory, since you only get to see the page so many times, you committed the memory the first time. So this is what's known as the Aleppo Codex. And this is a work, a joint work actually, of Bali Masora. I'm going to talk more about them later after I give you an introduction to the course. I think you've sort of seen enough here. I have two other pictures of codices that we scrolled through. What I'm trying to communicate to you, and I hope it's effective, is that the Tanakh you see in front of your eyes, the way you see it in a printed text in particular, did not come down from Shemayim that way. Tanakh, the Torah came down from Shemayim, but was given 2,500 years ago, 2,400 years ago, something like that. It came down as in some form, and it's been transmitted over the last 2,500 years. The way our Sifrei Torah, and more importantly our Sifrei Tanakh, our printed texts appear, do not look anything like, in terms of their overall form, what the Sifrei Tanakh would once have looked like. And we have to explore how we got from step A to step B. Now that in itself is not so controversial. But what I pointed out at the beginning about Rebroyer's change, and I suspect, I cannot even sure who was a severe one with a stray dot of ink, I guess I have to check somebody else's kept there, is that keeping the text in perfect form, just the letters, is not always easy. And we have to explore the question of how is the text preserved, and to some extent what the perfect job done. Daniel suggested earlier a very smart way of how you try to preserve a text, not simply by copying, but by counting. I mentioned to you the term Bali Masora. It's a question of what the word Masora means. Everybody thinks it means you hand over. However, some have pointed out that the word Mensamat Reish in Arabic means count, like Hebrew Shamat Reish. Some of you may know the Gemara Kiddushin. If not, I hope during the course of the day you learn it. V'lama Nikru HaRishon Sofen, and the answer is in day. Shahim Sofen called the Yosha the Torah, which is in fact what the Bali Masora did. They didn't just copy, they counted. And we will talk about that more later today. Okay. For the moment, you can turn around. And I'm going to ask you, we can bring this back if you want, but I'm going to give my computer a rest so we don't run out of power. Okay. Request, while I go through the roll, a couple of things. I had a couple of volunteers just to hand out. Hey, I need two volunteers. One to hand out readers. Okay, and then you can hand out syllabi. You can even have light. While I'm calling the roll, I would appreciate, aside from making sure you have a syllabus and a reader, if you could take out a blank piece of paper. I'm not collecting it. I do not wish to embarrass anybody. I think it's only good if you embarrass to yourself. Let me first ask a question before I make you write. How many people here think they can get up and recite the 24 books of Tanakh and 12 books of Tzviata?
Is that good?
I can say with or without being in order. You don't have to raise your hand, but I want you to write that down on a piece of paper.
It's more a self-educational exercise. Maybe at the end I'll ask whoever's written down all of them. Okay? Let me just go down to the roll. If your name is not listed, please let me know when I'm done, okay? Or if you notice I do alphabetically should have been, you can also stop me then. Arazi, you're here. Howard Berkowitz. Also, if you have a name you prefer to go by, please let me know.
Hi.
Hi. Where are you from?
Fairlawn.
Fairlawn, okay. You can just tell me where you're from, too. Judah Blumenthal? Is Judah here? No? What's that? Okay. Let's see how many drops you got. I must have scared him away before he met me. Benjamin Carl?
Benjamin.
Okay. Silver Spring. Okay, it's a nice place. Lawrence Klingman. Okay. I will do my best. It's going to take me a while to learn names anyway. So, Yosef Kahn.
Yes.
Right, got it.
Yes.
Yes. Lev Davidov. Daniel Dweck. Dweck. What did I say? I'm sorry, what's that? Daniel, okay. Where are you from?
Carousel.
Okay. John Fleming. Boy, how do you get that? I see you're in your middle initial. Yitzchak Fried, where are you? Are you here? Yes. Okay, we've met. You go by Yitzchak or Yitzchak? Okay. Tommy, you're here. Andrew Friedman?
Yes.
Wow, these guys are not going to... Amitai Glazer.
Yes.
Where are you from?
Staten Island.
Staten Island, okay. Jason Goldberg. Joseph Graber.
How are you?
Okay. Where are you from?
Upper West Side.
Upper West Side. Joshua Graber. And?
Josh.
Yeah.
Josh.
Where you originate?
From Memphis, Tennessee.
You don't need your brother?
Yeah.
Okay. Memphis, Tennessee. That's a very nice, a lovely city. Okay. Moshe Grunfeld. Where are you from?
Toronto.
Avram Harari. Okay. David Harari. Jonathan Hornick. Mr. Kamenetsky. Israel?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Eliezer Kamiansky?
Yeah, Ellie.
Okay.
From Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Abraham Canal?
Avrami.
Okay. David Cohn. Mayor Kovacs?
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you from?
Baltimore.
Not so many New Yorkers here. Michael Corrin. David, you're here. Yeah, you're right there. Okay. Joshua Levy?
Josh.
Daniel Magder?
Yeah.
Okay. And when you raise your hand, Donnie Manis? Is he here? Okay. David Marciano? Isaac Rice? You go by Isaac? Rosenbaum, you're here. There you are. You go by Shmuel? And Noam, you're here as well. Okay. Anybody I did not call? Okay, you are? Ellie Grunfeld? Okay, I mean that's... Okay, you met with me right now. I'm surprised you didn't...
She did, but she didn't send it to the registrar.
Oh, okay. How do you spell your last name?
S-R-O-K-A.
Okay. Fine. All right. People finish writing? You could have even written an abbreviation for two letters, you know, like that very interesting-looking manuscript we saw. You should know the books. It's a good idea. I take it as a given that if you haven't, don't know the names of the books, you haven't studied them. That isn't necessarily the case. There are probably people who studied some math but couldn't name the books, but I think they would be rare. About the class, technical stuff. One very important thing, please make sure to check your email. As a general rule, I like to email stuff. You don't have to use your Ymail email as your regular address, but I'm going to send it there. And what you can do, MIS is a web page on the YU's website, which contains instructions on how to forward your email from your Ymail to whatever address that you would like. So I will send stuff out that way. I expect that you will be checking. Occasionally there's an email, there's no email there, in which case I will have to get it from you. But that's something you should take care of. It's a useful thing in general. And this way there won't be any problems with that. In terms of the class requirements, there's a midterm, a final, and there will be four short quizzes on different books of Tanakh. They are on the syllabus. You'll see when the dates are. Now, one thing about the dates. There are 14 weeks of class, one of which is a midterm. Is anybody here not first time on campus? Okay. So there's something called reading week here. The schedule here can be quite brutal. Some of you might have figured it out, or some of you can see ahead. So a generally good piece of advice is do your work now. Don't let it pile up on you. But putting that aside, there is a 14th week, which by law is a week of class, and I will give class then, and I say this every year, but every year I get one more year removed from my student days. I understand how difficult the semester is, and therefore I offer the following option. If you would like, at some point, either during on a Sunday afternoon, to have class or the midterm. Usually I do it on Election Tuesday, which is not off on the calendar this year, so I don't have that choice. But if on a Sunday or something like that, to have another class or the midterm then, this way I don't have to hold class during reading week. Doesn't make a difference to me, but it might make a difference to you. If we decide to reschedule class that way, so then the class will be recorded and will be online for those who can't make it. I will let you guys decide that within the next week or two. If we do decide to give the midterm or to take an extra class, I think the midterm might be the most logical thing to do on something like a Sunday afternoon. It may not take the full hour and 40 minutes. It may take less. So if we decide to do that, then obviously subsequently the entire syllabus calendar is going to be sort of pulled up a week. You need to be aware of that. So either by the end of today, I'll take a vote. You can think about it, or next week, and we can decide whether we should in fact do that on a Sunday afternoon, and that should take care of that. A club hour is an option also. The only problem with club hours is that if you go overtime, you run into your next class, but okay, whatever. That's a choice. One day probably won't kill anybody. Attendance. I don't require attendance after today. It's the rule in this class, and in not all classes, but many classes, is lafum tzara agra. What you put in is what you're going to get out. You have to be here for the quizzes, and they're on the schedule, so you know when they are. But I will read the rule only so that I learn your names, not because I'm taking attendance and it counts one way for you or against you. If you really want to get the maximum out of the course, and there's some very important, minimally some very important makaris of Chazal that we are going to read, learn, and discuss, you will get much more out of it if you attend. If you somehow feel you don't like class, or you feel you get everything reading on your own in class, add nothing, you have my blessings, you don't have to show up. But if you're going to show up, please show up prepared. It really makes for a much better class. I don't really like those few of you who know my general style. I don't like straight-out lecturing. There's more of this than I might do in other contexts, but nonetheless, I prize and value discussion much more. I'd rather have everybody basically know the sources and the readings walking in, and we can discuss anything about them and go as far afield as we like, rather than having to be giving you the sources anew. Okay. Now, why some of us in Jewish studies in Yeshiva College consider this course very, very important? And one of the questions is, why do we consider it so important? So in terms of the goals of the course, the first goal that I would lay out is understanding how our Tanakh came to be the way we have it. And you can understand, based on what you saw earlier, exactly what that question is driving at. Second issue is that the goal of the course is primarily to expose you to the views of Chazal and Rishonim on various aspects that relate to the study of Tanakh. Except for 2 weeks of the course, which deals with the ancient Near East and its relevance to the study of Tanakh, the ancient Near East meaning other Mesopotamian cultures that were contemporary with the time or preceded the time of Matan Torah, the rest of the course is basically going to consist primarily, not solely, but just about all of various parts of the literature of Chazal. By that I mean Bavli, Yushalmi, Midrash Halacha, Midrash Agada, and related sources, and on texts of Rishonim. Many things that you may learn, and I'm sure some of you, although I don't know how many, have come to YU, and maybe you heard in Israel that this is a, it depends who teaches it also, it's a very controversial course. I don't know how many of you encountered it. Or if any of those, I'm not sure that I have the reputation of being the most controversial person. I probably don't have quite that reputation, but maybe anybody who's here didn't hear about that, so they went to a different section. But one of the reasons why this course may be somewhat controversial for some people is there are many things that you will learn here that contradict things that you have heard absorbed elsewhere. And that presents you with a dilemma, because if your Rebbe that you had in one place or another says X and I say Y, well, who's making what up? I don't expect anybody to take anything I say because I said it. That's not a reason for listening to what I have to say. If you had no way of verifying it, if I told you that there was a pasuk in a book of Tanakh that's not in our printed Tanakh, and you had no way of verifying except for my say-so, then you'd be faced with a decision. You have to decide, do you trust me, do you not trust me? Or do you trust whoever told you, this Rebbe or this person, or do you not trust them? But in this case, everything that we're going to study is going to be in the sources in front of you. And I would like to say about some of the Makoros that we look at that the most controversial ones are from Chazal. I want to give you one sort of example. If I were to ask you, what is Chazal's view as to when Torah Shebichtav was given? And what would the answer be? When was Torah Shebichtav given to be written down? And the answer is? Before, most of you are going to say, I heard Misinai. Okay, I would point out to you that if you learn the Gemara in Gittin, you will find out that neither opinion in the Gemara believes that. I don't want to tell you that there's no opinion anywhere in Chazal that believes that the Torah Shebichtav as an entity was given at Sinai. Ain't no such thing. Not in my Gemara, at least. The Gemara there has a machlokas whether Torah Megillah Nitna or Chasuma Nitna, which means either the Torah was given, the Torah Shebichtav was given pieces as the events happened, as halachos were given over, or it was given its entirety. It doesn't mean nothing was given earlier, at least Baal Peh, in Arvos Noah. If you hold Chasuma Nitna, it was given in one fell swoop in Arvos Noah. Otherwise, you hold Megillah Nitna, it was given piecemeal. At minimally, it refers to the stories, the history of Klal Yisrael in the Midbar. Unless you say that that's not so important, you would be in violation of the Rambam's Ikar and what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says. That a person can't look at different parts of the Torah and say that this is Ikar and this is Tafel. The Simna Hoysaf Pilegesh, a seemingly irrelevant pasuk in the middle of Parshas Vayishlach about the genealogies of Esav, is as Ikar as Anochi Hashem Elokecha. So clearly Chazal did not believe that the Torah as we have it was given at Sinai, Torah Shebichtav. Now, I suspect to many of you, not all of you, that that's a little bit of news. If you don't believe me, go look up the Gemara. If you think I'm misreading the Gemara, then please challenge me. It's not my finish. I suspect that if you would ask almost anybody in the yeshiva to tell you the same thing, if they thought for a moment. But my point is simply that many things that we start out assuming in life because we thought it, because we heard it somewhere, upon further analysis, don't necessarily concur, in fact, with what Chazal said. Rabbeinu Bachya, there's a passage in Rabbeinu Bachya where he's talking to someone about the importance of a more sophisticated study of Tanakh, and one of his observations that he makes to the person is that, you know, you're first taught Chumash when you're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. Now, there are things when you teach a 6-year-old, Vayeda Adam Odes Ishto, okay? And you encounter that pasuk, and many Vayeda Ruvein Vayishtavis Nilapi Legeshavid. What do you tell a 6-year-old? The answer is, you translate literally, and you hope he doesn't ask questions. Now, I would hope that by the time you're 15 or 16, you're ready to read the Chumash in a different way, in a much more sophisticated fashion. I personally remember being a sophomore in high school and having read Parshas Vayechath again, and I couldn't believe what the text actually said. Now, what actually happened in the discussion of the Gemara Shabbos, and there's more than one opinion, whether or not it's Gemara Kesavim, or whether or not it's an exaggeration, whatever it is, that I felt like wrong. But the fact is that my Rebbe who taught me, you know, in my yeshiva katana when I was, I don't know, in the second or third grade, well, he certainly, no matter what he thought really happened, whichever day in the Gemara he cited, he couldn't possibly teach me that. Obviously, he had to teach me something that was appropriate for my age. However, you hope that when you become older, you're ready to handle more sophisticated concepts. And not everything, for I would make the following comment. There are things that I would tell an adult audience in discussing the ancient Near East that I might or might not discuss here, and I certainly wouldn't discuss if I was talking to kids in elementary school. Because depending how sophisticated a person is and where he sort of stands in his religious growth, you have to know what is appropriate. But the bottom line is there are going to be sources here that contradict some of your sacred previously held assumptions. And my advice, as I suggested earlier, would be to follow the counsel of the Rambam. When the Rambam wrote his commentary on Pirkei Avos, he wrote an introduction to it called Shmona Prakim. And in Shmona Prakim, I believe it's before he actually has the 8 sections in the Hakdama to Shmona Prakim, if you can call it that. He writes at the end that when he writes his commentary on Avos, he's not going to tell, he's citing, he's plagiarizing in effect. He's citing from whomever, and basically, he's not going to tell you who says what, but you shouldn't think that any of this material is his. It's not his. Now, why does he say that he's not going to tell you who says what? Because he knows that there are certain people he's going to quote, translate Aristotle and Plato, whom people are going to reject what they say simply because the person has said it. And that's where you have the famous phrase coined, I don't know if it's a good translation or not, but Kabbalah emetu mishamor. That's what the Rambam says there, that the truth has to be accepted on whether it's true or not. It has to be evaluated on its own merits. I'll add one caveat to that Rambam, a Rambam in the Morah Nevuchim, which some of you may have heard quoted, and the way I'm about to quote it is not the way you heard quoted, but the way I'm about to quote it is, in fact, correct. You can go check it yourself. It's in Chelek Beis Perachat Hei L'Morah Nevuchim. The Rambam, in discussing the eternity of the world and how that potentially conflicts with Scripture, the Rambam there says that there were two theories of the eternity of the world, the Aristotelian view and the Platonic view. And I'm not a philosopher, but the Aristotelian view was inconsistent with many, what he thought, principles of faith of Torah. The Platonic view was not really inconsistent. The only problem is the Pesukim and Bereishis don't sound like it. And the Rambam writes that had the reason why he doesn't accept Aristotle and Plato is the following. He could have had a much easier time rereading the story of Bereishis so that creation would not be yesh me'ayin, would not be ex nihilo. He could have reread that more easily than the effort it took to reread all the Pesukim in the Torah that speak about God's physical characteristics. Hiskashmos, right? Yad Hashem, and things of that nature, where the Rambam reads them metaphorically. Right? He said he would have an easier time rereading the story of Bereishis, but the reason he didn't was twofold. Number one, Aristotle's view was not proven. That's true about Plato also. It simply was not his boyer b'mofes. Number two, the Aristotelian view he could never have accepted because it contradicts principles of faith. So the Rambam conceded that there was a limit to his freedom of inquiry. The Platonic view of the eternity of the world, it's not important you remember these details, but it's the principle that's important. The Platonic view, had the Rambam felt that Plato had proven his view, he would have reread Bereishis, he would have had no problems. The issue was simply that Plato hadn't really demonstrated, you know, philosophically that in fact he was correct. And in the absence of physical, philosophical, scientific evidence to the contrary, we read scripture, generally speaking, literally. But if there were compelling physical evidence of philosophical, scientific, he would have accepted Plato's view and he would have reread Bereishis. So there are limits to what the Rambam says. There are certain red lines. But in the absence of that, the appropriate approach is Kabbalah Emes V'Mi Shamara. One last comment, one step away from this discussion, is an issue that I really think is important. Is the issue of academic integrity, and this goes back to the issue of exams and any kind of work. I don't know if any of your professors have spoken to you about it or your abayim have spoken to you about it. I would guess the latter probably have not. I don't know if any of you take an English comp and have started with this already. We take academic integrity pretty seriously. I don't need to give a mush or shmooze about this. I think it's fairly obvious. When you hand in work, it's your work. In this case, it's going to be, for the most part, exams, so it might be a little more obvious there, but this is true for all other work, what's expected of you, whether it's in this class or another class. When you hand in homework, you hand in labs, you hand in an exam, and less specified otherwise, that is your work. And ein onshin ella in ke matirin, I'm not choshed anybody here that they would do such a thing, but you shouldn't come later, chas v'shalom, when something should happen and say, I didn't know. Your work as a Ben Torah, as a human being, so again, even not just a Ben Torah, is supposed to be your own work, and nobody else's. Okay. Now, on another level of introduction, I have a question. Why do we study Tanakh? In Lithuania, in Talosin, I don't think they study Tanakh. Now, I don't know. You know, it's legendary in their dormitory rooms or whatever function as a dorm. It's legendary, the Sfarim that certain people used to keep under their beds, the Sifriyati courses. I don't know if they had Tanakh, Lahavdil, Tanakh there as well, but certainly in Lithuania, for the most part, in the Lithuanian yeshivas, they didn't study Tanakh. It's been well known that this has been a long neglected view, unless you're from unless you were perhaps in the Sephardic world, the Tanakh was studied much more, but in the Ashkenazi world, it was greatly neglected. So, on the assumption that we're not neglecting it, why do we study Tanakh? Any thoughts? David?
Well, the reason is that this is the source of all our original source.
Okay, so one very valuable use, an underutilized source of philosophy, theology, morality, and ethics is, in fact, Sefer Tanakh. Since how many people in this room have studied in entirety or close to entirety any of the Nevi'im Achronim? Okay. Sefer Mishlei? Eov? Okay. So those works in particular, particularly that set of Svarim, I mean, you have a little bit of Kohelet as well, are basically a major source, maybe perhaps in some ways the most important source, but often overlooked for Jewish philosophy, for theology. Certainly one of two major sources. What's the other major source? Agadas Chazal. And so that is one very, very important part of studying Tanakh. Now, that, of course, is a more sophisticated approach. What are other reasons for studying Tanakh? And again, if I don't know you and you volunteer, just tell me your name.
Shmuel.
Okay, so you could argue from a perspective of Talmud Torah. Okay, but they studied Torah in Lithuanian yeshivas also, and they studied mostly day and night, but they didn't really study Tanakh. So the question is, why not? Yes. Your name? Yeah.
Eric. So, the people studying Talmud in Lithuania, it wasn't like everyone went to Shiva. Most people are very, very smart, and they could focus their more on Gemara than need to say, us, we're not, I mean, we have all streams
Your observation about the difference between Lithuanian yeshivas and our yeshivas, and yeshivas today, not just YU, is an observation that was made in a very forceful letter written by a Rosh Yeshiva, not signed, to Dr. Belkin about 50 years ago. In discussing curriculum revision, the Rosh Yeshiva made references to the Harvard Divinity School and also had several Latin phrases, so we can take a pretty good guess who wrote it. And his comment was that the Lithuanian yeshivas were a different Bria, only the elite studied there. But they still didn't know Tanakh, many of them. So that doesn't really explain it. Yes, we could argue maybe some of us, maybe the Hamon Am in yeshivas can't, and they still don't study Tanakh. But you might argue that, you know, in other places people can't handle it. But why didn't they study Tanakh there? Yes. So let me ask a question. What is the Chiyuv of Talmud Torah as formulated by the Gemara? Also Gemara in Kiddushin. Gemara in Kiddushin comes up a lot in this course. Vishinantam levanacha al tikri vishinantam ela vishilashtem. And the Gemara says, shlish b'mikra, shlish b'mishna, shlish b'gemara. Well, hold on a second. And that's how the Rambam Paskins, that's how the Mechaber Paskins. Right, so there is a Tosfos in Sanhedrin, quotes Ravina Tan, that the Gemara there, actually, if you read it carefully, was making fun of Bavel, making fun of the Talmud Bavli, but it's called Bavli because it's Bolo Bakol. So in the Gemara, if you're looking at the Gemara carefully, it was actually one of the Eretz Yisrael Amorim belittling Bavel. But Ravina Tan somehow took that as his cue and said that we, because the Gemara is a Belula with Mishnah and Tanakh, therefore we don't need to study the other things because we study it all when we study Gemara. Halavai that were actually true for most people. It might have been true for Rabbeinu Tam, and Rabbeinu Tam, as one of my professors likes to say, we learn Chumash and Rashi, but Rabbeinu Tam, he said about Rashbam, but it's true for Rabbeinu Tam, too, probably learned Chumash with Rashi, his grandfather. And so it might have worked for Rabbeinu Tam. I suspect it doesn't work for most of us. But yes, that is why Tanakh has in very traditional sources been neglected. There may be other factors as well, but the ostensible, let me put it this way, the rationalization for why Tanakh is not studied is Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam did not live in a world in which everybody split their time three ways between Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. Rabbeinu Tam one day woke up and said, you know, we should just learn Gemara. Rabbeinu Tam was responding to the fact that people in his day were already not studying very much in the way of Tanakh, and this is the way he justified it. Okay. Yes. You see?
Can we say that maybe like the first set, obviously the Rambam and some verses, they get to know Tanakh first, but like, it's not a stress because you can't be as an island, like, you should know it, and I'm not sure if you want to say that, like, you're saying that they didn't know it at all, but like, you should know it, and maybe, I don't know, not superficial, but you should know that it just makes sense.
I don't know. So there's no question that once a person has sort of mastered Tanakh in some form, that it's appropriate that he'll spend less time on that. That's true in theory at every level, even for mission as well. I suspect one of my most distinguished senior colleagues in the yeshiva once commented when this discussion came up that one of his cousins, made fun of him and referred to him as a Surva Mirabanam, but an Amaris Daraisa. in reference to his great brilliance in the study of Torah Shebaal Peh, but his ignorance of Torah Shebichtav. He said that with a smile. But clearly the reality is that even that superficial knowledge isn't known, and it's not clear to me why the knowledge has to be purely superficial. I would agree that there are ways, there's never a limit to things that you will see in almost any text, and Torah Shebichtav is no less than that. I understand why at a certain point people will spend much more time in Torah Shebaal Peh. The question is not why people don't throughout their lives divide their time threefold, but rather why the study of Tanakh neglected to the point that I can walk into a classroom with people who've been in yeshiva for 12 years and in Eretz Yisrael for a year or two, most of them, and most of them could still not name the 24 books of Tanakh, right? That's the question, in a sense. We know it has happened that way because it's happened that way. I don't know why. It wasn't part of a massive plan, but it did. Yes, Shmuel? Are you both? You are? You're Shmuel, aren't you? Yes. Are you also Shmuel? No, okay, so. Yes, Shmuel. I said Shmuel, yes. It said where? And what did it say? No, Bittul Beis Medrash. No, that's not Bittul Torah. You're thinking Kol Kisvei. You think the Gemara in Kol Kisvei, the Mishnah in Kol Kisvei says it made it clear you must seal with Suvim even though you're not supposed to be reading the Mishabbos because Bittul Beis Medrash. That's not Bittul Torah. That's because the only time for the Amid Aretz to learn any halacha was in the Drush on Shabbos afternoon. But it's much more fun to read Daniel and Ezra Nehemiah than it is to listen to the Rebbe give a Mishnah Berurah shir, but that's not about Pitzel Torah, right? That's something else. But that's only the Daska and Shabbos in the Drasha slot. Yeah.
So do you view it as a
But again, the assumption is, I don't want to prolong the discussion. There's a separate question of what historically has become a reality versus what should be, ideally. But that still doesn't explain, why people shouldn't know the basics of Tanakh. But it has happened. That's the way it is, But obviously, some of us believe in trying to rectify that a little bit. Yes. Question in the back? Your name? Yeah. Let me ask you a question. You're studying Kiddushin, okay? How much practical application is there for you? We here in this yeshiva, we never, for whatever convoluted reasons, we don't learn Yevamos. But if you learn Yevamos, how much practical application is there? Almost anything that's studied in traditional yeshiva, certainly. And we do some untraditional mesechtes here. But this year, certainly, we're doing one of the classic mesechtes, Lamaisa. Have you ever seen anybody go under the chuppah, and be mekadesh with, shirayim? The issue, and if you want a pragmatic, you would learn Shulchan Aruch, or you would learn Rambam Mishneh Torah. There's an argument to be made, but then we do it very inefficiently. That's not what we're engaged in. Anyway, so the bottom line is the study of Tanakh from the perspective of Talmud Torah is important. It's important as a work of theology and philosophy. It's also important in a way that most of us don't think about it because we don't think about our identity in these terms, but it's part of our nation and our national heritage. It's supposed to be part of our language, the way we think, the way we talk. When you read the Ramban, for example, in his Peirush on Chumash, and other types of commentaries, more often on Tanakh than not, but even sometimes not on Tanakh, you will see that the language and the idiom that many Rishonim write in, even sometimes Achronim, is biblical idiom. It's sort of part of, it's who we are. And so for many reasons, the study of Tanakh is important. If you want just one very straight Agadah, or Medrash Tanchuma, and Rashi quotes it, on Parshas Kisisa, Vayihi kechalo solo daberito b'har Sinai kechalo so, makala mikushetes b'choftal et tachshitin, af tamuchacham tzorach liyasbaki b'choftal et svarim. Of course, to know about the 24 tachshitim of a kala, you also have to know some Tanakh, to know where that comes from, because it comes from the third parak of Yeshayahu. But clearly, the issue of how much time is spent on the study of Tanakh versus the need to know Tanakh are two different issues. And if one is completed in some sense to study Tanakh, he might spend less time on that, but that's only afterwards. Okay. Now, what exactly is going to be our focus? So, one of the issues that we already outlined is going to be how Tanakh came to be the way we have it. We're also going to look at various kinds of tools that can be useful in the study of Tanakh. Ancient Near East is one of them. In addition, I want to take a little bit of time to show you something that will probably be in the fifth class. Some of you, I hope, have used at least a concordance, but all of you should be familiar with it, as well as what's known as a lexicon, otherwise known as a dictionary. I'm sure most of you use the dictionary, but probably almost none of you have used the dictionary of Biblical Hebrew. It's important to be aware of those tools because they can be very powerful aids in the proper study of Tanakh. We're also going to study the history of not Tanakh, but the interpretation of the history of the interpretation of Tanakh. I always like to ask the question: when did what we call biblical exegesis or interpretation of the Bible of Tanakh? When did that begin? When did the period of biblical exegesis begin? If you had to put, what's that? No. What was the?
Since they stopped writing.
That's correct. In fact, I would say even before they stopped writing it, I would say the day after Matan Torah, the history of biblical exegesis began. Every written text requires interpretation. There's no such thing as a written text without interpretation. I don't mean to be postmodern in saying that. Now, that's the earliest. So we know that's when it began. Where is the earliest recorded biblical exegesis? No, it's earlier than that. What did you say, Yitzi, by the way? No, it's earlier than that. In Tanakh. I'm going to give you one example of this. It says in last week's Parsha, it's Tuesday, so it's still this week's Parsha, it says, "Uvishaltavi achaltaba makom asher yichar Hashem lekecha bo, fanisa b'boker v'alachtalo alecha." So what do you do with the Karban Pesach? Uvishaltavi achaltaba. What does uvishalta mean? You're allowed to cook the Karban Pesach? I don't know. In Shemos it says, "Al tochlo mimenu na uvashem u'bushal b'moyim." Did anybody do Rashi in last week's Parsha? Shteimich of Echad Targum is a chiyu found in Shulchan Aruch. You don't need a Tanakh to know that. Simon Reish Pei. Hey, I think in Aruch Chaim. What's that? The Mechaber. Mechaber, who was a Sephardi, says that you can fulfill it with learning Rashi. Okay. And most people I know who loyally do Shteim. I like to do Unklus. But and Rashi, but the most people I know who actually do Shnei Mikra Echad Targum, they use Rashi. Okay? So what does Rashi... So I guess the rest of you didn't listen to Rashi, right? They question whether or not another translation language... We've already discussed the Beis Yosef quotes, we've shown them about that. But anyway, bottom line, what does Rashi say? Anybody do Rashi? Okay, let's step up. So Rashi says that Bishul is Be'esh. It means to roast it over fire. Can be called cooking as well. Now Rashi, he probably quotes it. That is not Rashi's interpretation. It is not Chazal's interpretation. It is the interpretation of the author of Divrei Hayamim. Because in Divrei Hayamim it says, and Chazal quotes this, Rashi will probably quote the Pasuk, Vayivashlu echa pesach bo'esh. That Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim is already coming to reconcile the seeming contradiction between a Pasuk in Sefer Shmos and a Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim. That isn't, I believe, the earliest case recorded in Tanakh of exegesis. I'm not going to go into it now. I think there's a pasuk in Hosea that already is doing something within Sefer Bereishis. We read it as Haftarah, but it's a very difficult pasuk. But bottom line is that we're also going to study the history of interpretation. Some of you said Rashi. The last thing we're going to do in the course is we're going to look at four major Rishonim to talk a little bit about their methodology. A colleague of mine in one of the morning Jewish studies programs, I call him a colleague anyway, not one of my colleagues in the yeshiva, but was appalled. He was apoplectic when he told to me he wanted to kill one of his colleagues, who told the following story about Rashi. A bunch of Mekubalim, did anybody hear this story 50 years ago, sat down to write what would be the perfect Perush on Tanakh. Okay? And it was too, I don't know, you know, you're hearing the story now third hand, and it was too long, so they cut it back, and they left with Perush Rashi. Okay? And there is a well-known statement of the Chida, but I suspect Rashi would have heavily disputed it, that Rashi was written in Baruch HaKodesh. There are a lot of, we're going to discuss this issue. I'm not accepting those assumptions. I have enormous respect for Rashi, but there was a method to what Rashi did, and the method wasn't Ruach HaKodesh. Rashi had some type of agenda. He tells us about it, and we will study what is Rashi's methodology. It's very popular now anyway, because I think this is like the 900th anniversary of Rashi's death is coming up, so there was a Rashi conference in Israel this past summer. We're going to look at Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, who, as I said earlier, learned Chumash with Rashi, and had some very sharp things to say about certain of Rashi's comments. He obviously didn't hold it was written Ruach HaKodesh. Ibn Ezra and Ramban. Okay, we're going to look at them and talk about their methodologies, and it's something when in the future you study, you should take, those are things you should carry with you, because that is something I hope most of you, you know, even who don't go into any kind of scholarship or teaching, will actually continue to do throughout your lives. Before you get to the Rishonim, though, obviously biblical interpretation was going on between the close of Tanakh and the period of the Rishonim, and some of you said Chazal, which comes in multiple forms, Agad and Halacha. Chazal, of course, were not the only Jews. Chazal is a very amorphous term. When we use the term Chazal, we usually mean the authors of certain specific works of literature, namely Mishneh, Tosefta, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Midrashei Halacha, Midrashei Agada. There were other Jews who lived at the time who were also interested in Tanakh. We don't always know their identities, particularly before Chazal, in the late Bayashani period, where we know there were multiple groups of Jews. There were Pharisees, who we generally accept were our forerunners of Chazal. There were Sadducees, and there were at least one other group, probably many other groups. Josephus refers to one who were called the Essenes, who some of you associate with the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not clear how much connection they actually had, but be that as it may, lots of Jews were studying Tanakh, and lots of Jews were writing books that we even have preserved from the late Vayishani period. There's a whole collection of literature which is not included in Tanakh, except for one book, which is almost. If you look at the syllabus somewhere, you'll see something about the 25th book of Tanakh, known as the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. Some of you probably heard of Sefer Ben Sira, maybe the book of Maccabees. Some of you might have heard of the book of Tobit. These were works mostly written by Jews, many of which, some of which don't relate to Tanakh. Maccabees doesn't really relate to Tanakh, although even there, there's some material. The way they quote Tanakh will tell you something about how they interpreted it. But many of these works deal with various aspects of Tanakh interpretation, particularly more stories. Some of them deal with law. And some of them you even recognize because they eventually survive in various agados of Chazal. So starting with already the late Vayishani period in all these works, including the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran, through Chazal. We don't have so much that I know about it from the Gaonic period on Tanakh. I'm sure there is. I don't know much about it. What's that? Right, okay. It's a fairly brief parish. There are others as well. I mean, if the Karaites were doing it, the Rabbinites had to respond, certainly. So there's a long, long history of the interpretation of Tanakh, and most of the course after probably the entire course, I'll scratch it. The second half of the course, after the midterm, is all going to focus on the history of interpretation. Some Targum, Medrash, Rishonim, a little bit of the non-traditional works we'll briefly look at, such as Dead Sea Scrolls and Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. But most of the rest of the course after the midterm is going to focus on those types of things, exposing them. Now, one of the things, one of sort of the larger questions that we will deal with at various points, and it's really more pertinent to the Rishonim, ironically, than Chazal, is the issue of Pshat. It's one of the things that we actually, in some ways, avoid. And when you study Tanakh and YU, and no one, for the most part, very few people actually do Bible. We usually do its interpretation. There's a reason why we shy away in our academic world from the study of straight Bible. And that is because if you were to go outside of the four walls of this institution, there would be very few places you as an Orthodox Jew could study Tanakh. That is because there are certain assumptions that we make about the biblical text, particularly the Torah, more so than Nach, but even certain aspects of Nach, which are not shared by the larger world. Some of these issues I'm going to expose you to in very, very brief form, and primarily for the purposes of what I would call inoculation. I don't want anybody to walk out of these four walls without having heard of what the documentary hypothesis is. How many of you have heard of the documentary hypothesis? Okay. Not so many of you. You should know what it is, not because you should believe in it, chas v'shalom, but you should be aware of what the rest of the world assumes. You should never walk out of this place and encounter somebody and all of a sudden be run over or shocked, because all of a sudden you discover that most of the academic world, almost the entire academic world, makes certain assumptions about the authorship of Torah, forget the rest of the books of Nach, that are completely alien to you, foreign to you, and is, from a theological perspective, unacceptable to you. As I mentioned earlier, when we study Tanakh, we have certain, when we study anything, we have certain principles of faith, as the Rambam said, which are not negotiable. There are certain issues we don't touch, no matter what we are intellectually convinced of. That's what Emuna is. And we are not going to discuss those at length, but at different points, particularly in the first part of the course, you're going to encounter some of those issues, and they're done primarily so that it shouldn't come as a shock to you later. One last comment. Okay, so I think I'll leave it at that. One other comment about the course. I hope there's no exodus for the door, but the assumption is that you can read texts of Chazal when you prepare. If you actually look at the syllabus, you're going to see, and I have over past semesters slowly cut back on some of the secondary readings and concentrate much more on various Ma'amari Chazal, it is important that you be able to read them, and obviously it's important that you take the time preparing them and thinking about them. If you have real difficulty with Hebrew, it's probably the wrong, I mean, it's a question of why you're in NYT and BMT. I assume there's nobody, it's possible, but I take it there's nobody here who's not in NYT and BMT, is that correct? Is anybody here who's not one of those two programs? Okay. And as such, but the Hebrew can be a sticking point. Okay. Now, let's come back to what we spoke about a little bit earlier. There was one or two other texts I wanted to show you, or we scroll through them a little bit quickly, that you should be aware of. I showed you two texts of Reb Breuer. You might have seen a title page with like a fancy gate or something like that, which was actually an edition of 1859 edition of, I didn't bring mine. You're supposed to bring a Tanakh to class. I didn't bring mine, okay? Make sure in general class you should have a Tanakh and the reader. Aside from anything else, that's usually most of what you need. And if you actually, some of you may have seen the Netter printing of Chumash. It's a one-volume Mikraos Gedolos. It has Mincha Shayef through each Sefer. And it has Targum Yonason. It's sort of, usually, the text is only on the right side, the left side, and the bottom of the right is always almost form of Farshim. So what you saw there, that's actually what's known as the Vienna edition of the Mikraos Gedolos, and that was first printed in 1859. If you go by this year, at this year's farm sale, the Netter Chumash, it's just basically a photo offset. In fact, you know what, I want to actually show you something that you will appreciate. So we'll do this, now I realize there's something you should see. So let's turn around for a moment as we start once again to travel the world of Tanakh. Put down. Yeah, you don't have to turn it down. Is the air conditioning on? What's that?
Yeah.
You're probably better off. If you want to learn this, it's up to you guys. If people would like the windows open. Okay. All right. Should come up in a second. Let's see. And warming up. Looking for signal. Here we go. Now, okay. Right, so that's where Breuer's early Tanakh, that's the Choriv edition. Now, this is the title page. You look in the bottom left, you can see it says Vienna, Wien, 1859. Now, this is a Chumash that is often served not the Malbim Mikraos Gedolos, but for the one volume Mikraos Gedolos, typically serves as a template. Now, okay, now this is a page, some of you might recognize this page. And a couple of things that are worth seeing here, but I particularly was interested in this because It's a little hard to see. I'm going to tilt it down. If I look at the top line, and if we had a better screen, you'd see it better. You see the word Pesach at the end? Pesach Omoed, last word on the first line. If you look at that tuff, does it look like other tuff? It's hard for you to see in this, but it doesn't. If you go back to the first edition, I don't have a first edition of this, you'll see that it's actually a samach. And no one retypeset it, and that's why if you look carefully at that tuff, or if you go to the library, or if you have a chumash like this at home, just go look in this, and notice that it's Dvarim Chav Zayin Beis, and the word Pesach was once spelled with a samach, which is obviously an error that's easy to understand how it happened. But nonetheless, it was corrected later, but it's not like they retypeset it. That's why they sort of erased the bottom, and they left it like that. That's why the tuff will look so funny. Similarly, there was another real egregious error, which was, and this is harder to tell, but on the second line where it says, Ki karash mital Hashem, so you'll notice there's unusual spacing before the Aleph. There's a little bit more of a gap than there should be, because in the first edition of the Vienna Chumash, there was a hey instead of an Aleph, Ki karash mital Hashem. I know it would have a much greater effect if I actually had the original, but if you check, I'll check in the library and see maybe they actually do have an original, and you would see those errors there. Now, what that obviously points to the fact is that no matter how good you are with the text, it's always possible for it to be corrupted. Now, before you turn around and we finish with this, well, I'll show you a couple of other things, but in this Chumash, if you look where I have the pointer, right here, can anyone read me what that says, that word? Masorah. That's the Masorah, which we are going to explore in just a couple of minutes, the Masoretz. And that is the Masoretic apparatus. Now, when you have it printed, like your Malbim Chumash won't even print this, but when you have this printed, it will be it's printed here. When you look in the codices of the Bali Masorah, and there we will go up once again. This is the second rabbinic Bible. Okay, this may look a little bit more like some of the Nachs that you see printed, the older Nachs you see printed. And this was the second printing, and this sort of set the stage for almost all later printed editions, which in some ways was unfortunate because there were some serious deficiencies in the Second Rabbinic Bible in terms of the text. Okay? But what you see here in the margins, and you can't read them now, but we will see some of them later in your reader, are Masoretic notes. And we're going to talk again, give me 1 minute, and we will talk about what Masoretic notes are. Now, this is a codex, which is the Cairo Codex from the middle of the 10th century, and those are Masoretic notes in the margins. Generally, all the codices that I've seen of Tanakh have three columns. That's the way they did them. And in the notes, in the margins, there are notes. We're going to talk about those notes. This is the Leningrad Codex. Anybody, any of you here have a Dotan Tanakh, Professor Dotan Tanakh? You may have it, you may not know it. This is the oldest complete codex we have of Tanakh. It's available actually in a fancy facsimile edition, the photograph. Anyone know the story of the Aleppo Codex? Which is this. Is there anything else? I think that's all you need to see from it. Alright. The Rambam refers to the Aleppo Codex. We believe to be the Aleppo Codex. I'm not going to do the whole history. The Aleppo Codex was a codex which was, it was written by a Masoretic scribe, and the vocalization was done by Aaron ben Asher. Who was Aaron ben Asher? David? No, that sounds like an apocryphal version. He never met the Rambam. The Rambam never met him, I should say. Yes, Mayor?
Yes.
Okay. Now, remember I showed you earlier three sets of Nekudos? Now, one of them is almost unknown. The one that had the psukim abbreviated, that's known as the Palestinians, forgive the term, Nikud Eretz Yisrael. Okay, Palestinian vocalization. These terms were developed at a time when Palestine meant British mandate. Okay, so, you know, forgive if I slip into that terminology. The second one that you didn't recognize, the one that was used standardly until recently by Teimanim, is Nikud Bavli. The only difference between Nikud Bavli, the only differences between Nikud Bavli and Nikud Tveriani, the Tiberian vocalization, which is what we use, there are three differences. One, the nekudos are written on top. Two, the shape of the nekudos for most of them, not all of them, are different. And number three, there's no difference between patach and segel. It's all patach. That's not a surprise. Arabic also has no distinction between the two. Now, I'm going to forget about the other systems, although later in the semester when we look at Targum, you're going to see the vocalized Targum manuscripts, mostly which we have preserved because the Teimanim, the vocalization is on top. But who were these people? Who were these Bali Masora and Feria? They are the ones, for us, bottom line, because we use for the most part their vowels, they are the ones who gave us our apparatus for Tanakh. They were people who focused their energies on Tanakh. There's been some debate in the scholarship recently as to whether or not, in fact, an Usher might have been a Karaite. He's the most famous. It might be a little disturbing. I find it disturbing. It might be true, but I find it disturbing anyway. It doesn't really matter. We know, some of you know of Aaron ben Usher, or what David mentioned before about the Rambam scribe, because the Rambam checks different Sifrei Torah. In the Mishnah Torah, he writes about this because he gives you the parasha breaks. In Hilchos Sefer Torah, he tells you which are psuchos, which are stumos, and a number of other things about how certain things in the Sefer Torah are written. And when he talks about the psuchos and stumos, and a number of lines in Shiras Hazinu, he tells you that it was based upon a very old Sefer that he saw in Mitzrayim, which was done by Ben Asher. Now, Aaron Ben Asher was one of the last of the great Masoretes. He was of the Ben Asher family. And the Ben Asher family in Tveria was one of the major Masoretic families. They gave us, in effect, this manuscript for the Rambam, and effectively for us, becomes sort of the last say. It's known as the Aleppo Codex. Originally, people doubted that, in fact, it was the Rambam Sefer, but in fact, it's assumed to be the Rambam Sefer. The Aleppo Codex was kept in Assyria, in a shul in Assyria, in a town named Aleppo. Unfortunately, the community was very possessive, and they rarely let people in to see it or photograph it. And unfortunately, during the 1948 war, when the Arab mobs rioted and set fire to the shul, most of the Torah part disappeared. From Hazinu and on was preserved. There's also somebody walking around New York City with a small fragment of Shmos in his wallet. He let them photograph it. There's someone who picked it up from the burning shul when he was there. It's now somewhere in Eretz Yisrael. I don't know where it's kept. Most of Nach is preserved. Now, it's a great loss, of course, because we don't have most of the Torah there, the part that's, in fact, most interesting for us. These codices, and you saw a few others, are what we have, the legacy of the Masoretic period. And what they did was they established for us written systems of vocalization, our written system. There was more than one, obviously. They established our written system of trop, which, by the way, has changed. For the amusement, the shapes of the trops and even the names have changed over the last 1,000 years. My favorite example of this is the following. Where is the Tlisha Gadola written in a word for the Bali Kriya? Some of you are Bali Kriya, right? I must have some Bali Kriya here, yes? Tlisha Gadola is always written before the word, or Tlisha Kana is always written after the word? Anyone want to guess why? I wouldn't have guessed it on my own. The reason is that once upon a time they were written the same way, just the circle. And because of that, the only way to distinguish them for the Bali Masora was to write one before the word and one after the word. Now that they started, that looks like a horn almost, or half a horn or something. So now we can distinguish them just by looking at them. But basically, the way you distinguish truff that looks alike is by way you place it on the word. Hence, again, for the Bali Kriya, if you know Kadma and Pashta, the reason why Pashta is always on the last letter is because exactly to distinguish it from Kadma. So the Bali Masora were responsible for giving us that system, those systems. The Pasuk breaks they also recorded for us. It's clear Chazal knew about Pasuk breaks, although they may have been a little bit amorphous. You learn the Gemara in Kiddushin. Let's see if it's in here. I cannot believe it's not in here, but maybe it's not. You look up the Gemara in Kiddushin, I think it's Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. Any more syllables? Okay, I'm a little surprised and disappointed that I didn't bother to put it on. But the Gemara, I think it's Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph in Kiddushin, where the Gemara says, it's a very famous Gemara, about the quoted tradition that the Vav of Gachon is the middle letter of the Torah. And I think Abaye asked Rabbi Yosef or something like that, you know, which side, the first half, the second half, means the last letter of the first letter of the second half, and the aunt of Yosef answers him, I don't know, and they say, let's go count. And the answer is, we can't, because we're not the key in the chaseres. Now, lest one think that this lack of certitude with respect to the Malay and Chaser in the Torah was limited to Malay and Chaser, the Gemara later speaks about which pasuk is the middle pasuk of Tehillim, which pasuk is the middle pasuk of the Torah. The Gemara there says there are 5,888 psukim in the Torah. Our Sifrei Torah have 5,400. And the way we break things down, it's not necessarily a difference in the text, the way we break things down, I think, is 5,485, according to the Masoretic count. They say that Divrei Hayomim has, I forget, one of something has, I think, well, Tehillim has eight more than the Torah, right? Now, our Sifrei Tehillim have about 2,500 psukim, rather than 5,800 and something psukim. And then the Gemara says on that as well that we can't count because B'marava in Eretz Yisrael, when they broke that, they took the following pasuk, and obviously in Bavel it was one pasuk, but they broke it down into three. Hinanochi boilecha bavanon, and so on. The pasuk in Parashat Yisrael, it's a long pasuk, but in Eretz Yisrael they treated it as three pasukim. So clearly, in terms of where pasukim were broken, Chazal, there was a certain degree, certainly in Bavel, of lack of certitude. Even in terms of the system, was there trust in the time of Chazal? Absolutely. There was some type of system of what we call Piskei Ta'amim, but the only question is how fixed it was. The Gemara in Yoma says that there are five psukim which have no hechrea, which means that we're not sure how to read a certain word in the pasuk. For example, Uvaminora arba'a givim mishukadim kaftarau fracha, and they were uncertain whether mishukadim went with the first half of the pasuk or the second half of the pasuk. Now, our truck has an asnasta before mishukadim, but Chazal were not certain as to how that pasuk was to be read. So the Bali Masora basically gave us the text as we see it. Not the consonantal text, but they gave us the system of vocalization, at least the written symbols, the system of written truck. It's not that they invented things out of thin air. Obviously, they had a reading tradition of how you pronounce words. They probably spoke the language to some extent. And they created a written system to help transmit that. I highly doubt that we pronounce anybody. Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Taimani actually pronounces Hebrew the way the Bali Masora pronounced it exactly in terms of the sounds. I doubt anybody in Spain in the 14th century pronounced it exactly the same way. But we all follow some type of reading tradition with certain consistency based upon those vowels. What else? That was a major part of what the Bali Masora did. They did something else very important as well. You notice, if you look in the reader, if you turn the page, what number is it? 27. The page numbers are written in a handwriting somewhere on the page. It varies. In this case, it's on the bottom right. One of the problems forget which word it was. Someone in my shul read in Parshas Bamidbar. I forget which pasuk. I think it was in the second parak where you had all these repetitions. And one of the pasukim, it's like Al Tzava or something like that, is missing a word. I mean, it's not in the pasuk. And when he read it, it's a little different. It's missing one word from the other three cases. Like there are four galim, and it was missing a word. And the person read it, and he filled in the word. It's a great teaching mistake, right? It's a very, very experienced and a very good Baal Kriya. He just added in the word because each one of the other three cases repeats the exact same thing, and he added in the word. I don't remember what the word was, and I listened to that and I said, why did he do it? Because you're used to reading it that way. Now, that happens that when scribes copy text, are scribes perfect? If you ever look at manuscripts, you'll discover very quickly they are far from perfect. They are prone to all sorts of human errors. Eyes skip lines, or when lines end on the same word, scribes often skip from one to the other, or end up duplicating one, because their eye, when it goes back across the line, goes to the wrong place. It's a very natural form of human error. If a pasuk appears in identical form, in one case it says sason v'simcha yasigun, and the other one it says sason v'simcha yasigu, you can very easily imagine how a scribe is accidentally going to level one to match the other. And all sorts of these things, malay v'chaser, if you get the same phrase, or not the same phrase, the same word that occurs in 20 places, it's easy to imagine how a scribe is going to make a mistake and copy one as malay when it should be chaser, or chaser when it should be malay. How do you prevent those kinds of errors? And that's what David suggested earlier. You count. Well, that's very nice. You count. What does it mean? It means if you want to transmit Tanakh and you have the word, for example, he, which is normally spelled how? Hey Vav Aleph in Torah, throughout most of Nach is Hey Yud Aleph. But there are either 9 or 11 exceptions in the Torah where it's spelled with a Yud. Well, as you can imagine, any of you laying Tazria Mitzorah, you wish that Moshe Rabbeinu had been told to write he all the time with a Yud. Okay? Because then you could actually distinguish between he and who. And there aren't, unfortunately, not all 11 occurrences, I think it's 11 that we have, occur in Parshas Tazria Mitzorah. It would be nice if that much we could get. But bottom line is, it's very easy to make mistakes. So what you would do is you would have a notation, firstly, to tell you that the word he appears with a Yud in the Torah 11 times. So if you then were copying out a Sefer Torah, you copied over a manuscript, and now you wanted to check that you hadn't made errors, one of the things you would do is, when reading through it, you'd make a notation of how many times you had he spelled with a Yud. If you came up with 10, or you came up with 12, you would know that you had an error. Now, it might be very laborious and time-consuming to find the error, but you would know that there was an error there. And that, in effect, is what Masoretic Notes are about. Now, you'll read on your own, an article in the Encyclopedia Judaica known as Masora. Now, unfortunately, some genius chaver of yours years ago decided that he really liked the article so much that he ripped it out of the page. He ripped out the page in the library. Fortunately, there are two other avenues of obtaining this, and the truth is the one in the library would be hard to find anyway because it's not printed under M. It was in some supplementary volume. Number one, there is a computer version. Number two, at some point, I may send this out via email. I have actually taken it off the CD-ROM. The library has a CD-ROM, and anybody who would like the article, in a Microsoft Word format, I will be happy to, maybe I will email it to everybody, and that way you can read it that way. There are parts of the article that are it's like 40 pages of the article, but you're only expected to read probably about 15 of them. I have made the rest of the article in very small typeface, so if you want to read it, you can blow it up, but it'll be pretty obvious. It's like the first 7 pages and another 8 or 9 pages or something like that shortly thereafter, but it's pretty obvious. You can read all about these things. I'm only going to mention just a couple of general observations, and I want to look at a few Masoretic notes before going on. Number one, there are two Masoretic apparati. One is known as the Masora Gedola. One is known as the Masora Katana. When you have a page like this, and you want to write notes in the margin, what do you not have a lot of? Room. And therefore, the notes are going to be very abbreviated. You have separate svarim, or at the ends of svarim, where you actually have Masoretic lists called the Masora Gedola, where things are spelled out at much greater length. Here, let's take an example. If you look at this page, okay, firstly, the most common note, you see a lot of lamed. Lamed is a word that means a letter that stands for lessa. It means that form of the word, exactly as you see it appears nowhere else in Tanakh. For example, if you look on the on sort of the left of the two full columns that you can see, if you look down 5 lines in the regular Hebrew in text of Yeshayahu, it says La Yosif Yavovach Od. On the word Yavod, there's a little circle which takes you to the margin, and there it says Les Chaser. It means that this word is Yavo is written Chaser, and there are none other like it. Now I think the next word that goes with that, it might be Besifra. It might be the word Yavo. I'm not sure. It might be nowhere else in Sefer Yeshayahu does the word Yavo appear Chaser Vav. If you go over to the right margin, for example, the first Hebrew on the page, Va'asim Dvarai B'fi'echa, okay, and it says, Hey, it's hard to read them a little bit, Chaser, it means there are 5 times in Tanakh that the word Va'asim appears without a yud. Okay, and you can go down. If you want, in the Encyclopedia Judaica, he has a list of the most common Masoretic symbols. I have in the past, it's not that this is so important, on the midterm occasionally given a page like this and asked you to identify a couple of symbols. I might or might not. You can take your, usually have choice anyway. You will probably find it a very interesting experience just to take one column and go through it and see. And what you want to do while you're doing that is either take a concordance, or better if you have a Bar Ilan or another database with where you can search the Hebrew text of Tanakh, and you can check whether the Masoretic notes are accurate or not. Usually we assume they're accurate, so if you came up with the wrong results on your search, maybe you're not searching right. But nonetheless, it's a very interesting exercise just to see, to start to notice, these things. Now you realize, obviously, that these people, we probably, if you met them, I imagine they would have been a bunch of guys, you would have met them, and they would have been walking around like, mumbling to themselves notes and lists and words of various kinds, you know, various words in Tanakh that appear how many times. It is a recipe, I'm told, that the person who did many of the concordances to rabbinic literature, I think it's Kasovsky, went out of his mind at the end of his life. Now, I don't know if that's true, and I don't know whether or not it was the kind of person who was attracted to this kind of work in the first place, or was spending all his life generating concordances on Shas and on Midrash Halacha that would have made a person crazy. Either one could happen. Obviously, I'm not saying that the Bali Masor, you know, went out of their minds, but obviously it requires a certain kind of personality and a certain kind of perseverance and a certain kind of knowledge of Tanakh. I'm sure I could go through this room, even Bali Kriya, and ask you about certain words and ask you whether you think they normally saw Malay and Chasser, and you probably couldn't tell me. And the reason I suspect almost nobody could tell me is because you're not used to thinking about these questions. Unless you know the grammar well and certain patterns of Biblical Hebrew, it means nothing to you. Because what difference does it make whether it's written Malay Vav, Cholam, or Chasser Vav? And the answer is, it doesn't. I mean, it matters when you write a Sefer Torah. When you write a Sefer Torah, you copy from another good Sefer. But it's not an issue we're used to thinking about because it doesn't usually matter so much for us. For them, this was a very big issue. Okay. Anyway, I think that's that. So now I think you should hopefully have an appreciation for what the Bali Masorah did and what they've given us. They are one major link in the chain of tradition of the text of Tanakh. And obviously they preserved they didn't only create vowels and stuff, they obviously preserved the text. They did such a good job of what I would call standardizing the text, because I presume they had different, I would venture to guess the following. If you go into your shul and you have the Sefer Torah scanned, and the computers do a perfect job, you rarely find two Sefer Torah that have the same text, if ever. And the computers aren't perfect, I know, because I know once in my shul we had a new Sefer Torah, Bar Mitzvah kid I taught read, and I did a really good job of teaching him, and I know that because he read what was in front of him, not what he thought should have been, and there was an extra vav, like v'im minchala machavas karbanach. I know it was somewhere in Parshas Vayikra, where there was a vav that either wasn't there or was there and should have been there, and he read it what he should have done, which was what was in front of him, and everybody screamed, and of course it wasn't his fault, it was the Sefer Torah was wrong. Not only was it checked by probably more than one sofer, it was checked by a computer as well, and obviously OCR software has its limitations. Nonetheless, the Bali Masorah did a remarkable job of standardizing our Sefer Torah, and by some almost nace, even though the work was really completed in Eretz Yisrael by the 10th, 11th century, and world Jewry had already fragmented, and Bavel was its own world without Eretz Yisrael, and Teman was its own world, nonetheless, somehow, the standardization of our Sefarim was so well established by the Bali Masorah that Ad HaYom HaZeh, certainly in the text of the Torah, there are almost no variants. There are a few. There's one Parsha break in Parsha Tzav, which the Teimanim have in one place, and Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, I think, have a little earlier in what's in Perek Zion. Everybody, I'm sure, knows Tzua Daka with a hey or an aleph is the difference between Sifrei Sfarad and Sifrei Ashkenaz. And there's a place in Parshas Noach, where every year I know that there are Balabasim going to scream out in the shul, where it's either Vayihi Kol Yimei Noach or Vayihi Yu Kol Yimei Noach. But as a general rule, it's really, the Bali Masorah did an astoundingly good job in preserving and transmitting the text. Now, of course, the Bali Masorah they received the text as well. And the question is, what happened to the text? So we know what's happened since the Bali Masorah did their work, because we have, literally, physically, codices of the Bali Masorah. The question is, what happened to the text between the time it left Moshe Rabbeinu's hands and the time it got to the Bali Masorah? Now, we're really, for the most part, not going to ask that question because we can't answer the question. We don't have a copy of Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah with Yoshua's signature below, indicating in a Ksav Yad Yosef Makomacher that is Yoshua ben Nun is verifying it's Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah. The earliest sperm we have, and we don't always know what to do with them, are the materials from Qumran. The next earliest source we have of Sifrei Tanakh are not actual Sfarim, but evidence from Chazal about what text they had in front of them. Now, I'm going to leave you, this is out of character for me, but I promise you that you should not lose any sleep over it. It may force you to revisit certain assumptions you made, but I'm going to leave you hanging a little bit with the next source that we look at, which is the Gemara in Shabbos. And the Gemara in Shabbos really relates to a fundamental question. Are there any differences between the Sfarim that we have and the Sfarim that Chazal has? Now, when I say the Sfarim that we have, our Sfarim are basically the Sfarim of the Bali Masorah, which date from the earliest, the 10th century. Not much later than that, the 10th or 11th century. Now, when you read a Gemara, and you see a pasuk printed there, and it differs from what you find in all our printed Tanakh, and our Sifrei Torah, what conclusion should you draw? That the printer was sloppy. Correct. Bad editing of the Shas. There are tons of psukim that are misquoted in the printed text. Doesn't mean Amorai misquoted. It just means the people who did the Vilna Shas or the earliest scribes, they weren't paying that careful attention. That tells you absolutely nothing about the text that Chazal has. But you look in the Gemara in Shabbos, 55 Nun Hamad Bay, source 17. And I'm willing to bet, although I'm not 100% sure, that Rabbi Kiva Eger on this Gemara, on this Tosfos, might be the longest from Kiva Eger and Shas, and the Gideon of Shas at least. It's page 17, and you can appreciate, you can see the Gideon of Shas there. You know, Rakiv Eger is well known in the Gemara Shas for giving you five words and you're supposed to figure out what the question is. He was vested only by the Gros comment. So you can see how long this Rakiv Eger is. The Gemara here is in the middle of a discussion as to various biblical figures who did or didn't sin. I'm not really going to talk about this at length other than to tell you that you all well know that Reuven didn't actually have a sexual relationship with Bilhah, his father's concubine. If you believe Rabbi Lazar Madai and Rabbi Gamliel, if you believe Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, he did. We all know the first day. We're not so familiar, many of us, with the second day. It's an interesting Gemara. You should read the entire Gemara from start to finish. It's the same Amora, time after time, who says that Ploni didn't sin, Ploni didn't sin, Ploni didn't sin. The Gemara in almost every case quotes dissenting opinions. We're often only taught one side. I recommend you read the Gemara, but I'm not interested in that now. I'm interested in the following case. It's one line the Gemara has at the bottom. The Gemara says that B'nai Eli, Rav Shmuel Nachmani Amar Yonah says, Kala Omre B'nai Eli Chatu Eino Elatoa. Anyone who says that Eli's children sin, he's making an error. The Gemara says, how can you say that? And they quote various psukim where Eli describes, or the Navi describes, the sins of Eli's children in the plural, with plural verbs. First, the Gemara tries to say that Pinchas didn't sin, obviously, and if Pinchas didn't sin, Eli didn't sin. Now, how do you know Pinchas didn't sin? Because it only uses verbs in the singular. So each time the Gemara goes through it, asks the Kasha, the Gemara gives the teretz. When you get to the third line from the bottom, it's marked off very clearly. It says, V'hoksiv ma'avirim. Eli says to his children, these bad things I hear about you, ma'avirim am Hashem. Ma'avirim is a plural verb, plural participle. Am Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua Ma'avirom Ksiv. Now, what text did Chazal have in front of them? I don't care what is printed in the Gemara. Looking at this line in the Gemara, can you tell me what did the text look like that Chazal had? How do you know that? Because the whole... Maybe there's a mistake in the printer in front of you. I told you, there are lots of places the Gemara misprints. Yes. The whole drusha could not have, you're correct, it is Ma'avirom, but the whole drusha could not have taken place without having Ma'avirom. Now, there's a Rashi you can read, and I'm going to read you just a line in Tosfos and let you think about it some, but this is Tosfos. Tosfos says, Ma'avirom Ksiv. Anybody want to read? A volunteer. Go ahead. Obviously, Tosus is assuming our Svarim, well, it depends which Svarim he's referring to. The Gemara says Mavi Rum, our Svarim have Ma'av Rim. It's Mavi Rim. It's written Chaser Yud, but it's the earlier Yud. The Chain. So before you go on, let me just tell you what the Yerushalmi says. The Yerushalmi has the following. One pasuk says, "Vayishfot Hushafadis Yisrael Esrim Shana," and the other pasuk says, "Vuhushafadis Yisrael Arba'im Shana." Now, if you any of you know Shoftim well enough, will know that if you open our Sifrei Tanah, and Tosfos is about to say this, both times by Shimshon. So the Yerushalmi, both times by Shimshon, it says, "Hushafadis Yisrael Esrim Shana." Now, for our Sfarim, there's no stira between the two. And the pasuk repeats itself twice at the end of two different units. That's not really a real stira. The Yerushalmi gives a drasha based upon this, that even 20 years after Shimshon had died, if he would go up to a plishti, he would say, "Shimshon." He would just tremble. He would just be frightened by it because it just evoked such palpable fear. And that's how you can explain that he only living in his lifetime, he judged them 20 years. But the after effects lasted for a total of 40 years. It's very clear from the Yerushalmi that they had in one of the two places Arba'im Shana. There's no way of escaping that. It doesn't matter what's printed in the Yerushalmi. But the whole drasha is built upon the fact that one pasuk said Esrim and one pasuk said Arba'im. So Tosfos just says the same thing you find by the Yerushalmi, that it says 40 and 20, Uvechol Svarim Shalanu Ksiv Chaf Shana. So Tosfos here lists two examples. It's something to think about for next class. You should already be preparing everything that was on the first two classes on the syllabus, because you obviously didn't get it before. There's no rush to read the article on the Masoretic materials, but when you have a chance, now is probably a good time to do it. Please make sure